in the world of sports. She's got next. Next. Here's Jordan Robinson.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Happy July. Happy summer. Welcome to another episode of She's Got Next. I'm Jordan Robinson, your host and overall yapper on all things women's sports. Once again, we have an amazing show for you. We've got the latest headlines, the most up-to-date news, and we have a wonderful interview for you later on with an investigative sports reporter. It's all here. You're in the right place if you want to hear about women's sports. Also, I want to send a huge thank you to those of you who've reached out and said how much you've enjoyed the show on your local stations, or who've sent me messages saying how much you've learned after listening to an episode, especially the gentleman from Philly who said he loved listening in the car with his two daughters on the way to the golf course. That just made my heart smile. So that's what the show is all about. It makes me so, so happy. So thank you. Thank you for listening. In case you missed it, last week we had WNBA commentator Cindy Brunson on the show to give us an around the league check-in on the WNBA as we inch closer to the midseason All-Star break. WNBA All-Stars July 18th through the 20th in Indianapolis, Indiana. As a reminder, in case you forget, it was an awesome conversation as we looked at the recent expansion news of new teams popping up in Detroit, Cleveland, and Philadelphia by 2030. We highlighted the most recent expansion team, the Golden State Valkyries in San Francisco, and how they have not only put on a marketing masterclass with 10 in a row sold out home games, but they've also been really, really good on the court. Right now, they are a playoff team. In previous years, expansion teams have not won more than five games in their inaugural season. So big, big difference. And with Portland and Toronto coming into the league in 2026, there are some big shoes to fill, but I hope they're taking notes because the Valkyries, they got it figured out. Cindy and I discussed how it's a testament to the talent level in women's basketball right now. And speaking of talent, she also talked about how Paige Bueckers is worth the price of admission. We know this. Paige Bucket Bueckers, who is coming off of her national championship with UConn, is a heavy rookie of the year favorite. So we also talked about that. If you want to go back and listen to that full episode, it's available wherever you get your podcasts. All right. In today's episode of She's Got Next, I really wanted to dive into women's sports fandom and what women's sports fandom kind of looks like, especially if you're new to women's sports. This is a topic that I feel like we broached slightly over the past few months, but there is some fascinating data and research that has gone into this topic, especially the rise and changes that have been occurring in various women's sports in recent years. Later in the show, you'll hear from our guests as they dive deeper into this topic, and they have researched a ton on this, but I wanted to provide a brief primer. So Wasserman's The Collective, which is the powerhouse agency's branch, that's a women-focused global impact and advisory business that exists to drive rationale to invest in women. They released a global research study in late 2024 on women who are fans of all sports, but also women's sports, to show growth and how the data should drive the market and profitability of women's sports overall. So out of approximately 1 billion females across 30 countries that they surveyed, 684 million were fans of female sports. That is a 10% increase over the past 3 years. Now, within that data, we find that the female sports fan cares about what sports and teams impact their values. When asked if they were more likely to believe that teams, leagues, and athletes should support social causes, an overwhelming number of women voted yes, 70% for both the whole entire sport and the whole team. And this makes sense. When we look at professional women's leagues like the NWSL and the WNBA, they are more progressive than their male counterparts, more outspoken on certain issues, and aren't afraid to make statements on what they believe is right and wrong. Because that represents the fans and the live event spaces. Typically, games, live games, are more inclusive, more celebratory, and more positive overall. The fans are there for the love of the game, but it's also provided a safe space. You've seen so many fans talk about that when it comes to women's sports arenas. And this goes beyond how June was just Pride Month, and there were so many Pride-specific games or different things along those lines. But it's just overall not so controversial. It is a safe space to be and to root on their favorite teams. It was also super interesting to me from the Wasserman Collective study was the age of the average female sports fan, with both boomers and Gen X at 60%, millennials at 74%, and Gen Z taking the cake at 79%. This goes back to our previous guest, sports reporter Rachel Axon, discussing kind of that idea of a lack of generational fans in women's pro sports because, frankly, they haven't been around long enough. But that's coming, and that's what's super excited. I love, personally, as somebody who's in that millennial category, I love seeing young kids, young fans, especially when it comes to college sports, all women's sports, really, just being so outspoken, but being so engaged in their fandom. That has been something for me that I have noticed, I have been paying attention to, and I have been liking all of the posts, all of the content around it. I think they're not only watching, but they're making content around their favorite players, around their favorite teams. That's bringing more of their friends and more of their cohort involved in women's sports. So that has been super interesting to me. But the rise of interest from young people is what's pushing the women's sports forward, the women's game forward. But there's also elements of it that this growth comes at a cost. And sometimes it's a literal cost. While females are increasing their interest in women's sports, so are many males. That's up 23% over the past 3 years for men, their involvement and their excitement around women's sports. With that comes a rise in eyeballs, but also men who typically engage in tribal men's sports, like football, for example, coming into these historically women-dominated spaces. One of those repercussions of a peaked interest in more women's sports is the increase of ticket prices, like the literal cost of growth. Forbes reported ahead of last NWSL season that tickets went up by 49%, with the Kansas City Current, who had the first stadium built specifically for their team, having the most expensive tickets. So there lies the conundrum. We want the facilities built for women's sports. We want more eyes on women's sports. But then, and yes, men too, you can come on over. We want you here. But from a business perspective, someone has to pay for it. And that's where we get into this murky conversation of some OG fans that have been around the WNBA since 1997 saying, hey, whoa, 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 I do like this growth, but now my pockets are hurting because of it. There are also some fans who are like, I am here for the growth. I want my money to go towards the increase of ticket prices because that means that players get more money, the league gets more money, gets to be profitable, and that whole conversation of the disparities between men's sports and women's sports becomes mute. It doesn't hold weight if I am participating and being an active participant in paying my share. So there is a lot there. And in a few minutes, you'll hear from our guest today Albert Samaha, a reporter for the Washington Post, dive deeper into the subject, especially when it comes to the WNBA and its boom recently. All right. So before we get to our guests, let's do a quick Women's Sports Week recap. International football, aka soccer for us Americans, is booming right now with the UEFA Euro Championship, African Cup of Nations, and Oceania all in action at the same time. On the opening day of the Euro, it was unforgettable with 34,063 fans packing the stands, marking Switzerland's most attended women's football match in history. In history, we're making history, people. A couple other notable numbers from Euro that I have to tell you about. This year's tournament is expected to generate over $38 million in sponsorship revenue, up 112% from the event in 2022. That was the last time this tournament was held. 19 NWSL athletes are set to compete in the 2025 tournament. This year's tournament boasts a 41 million euro total prize pool, representing a 156 increase from the last tournament in 2022. The tournament has achieved record-breaking ticket sales with more than 600,000 tickets already sold. Last one on the international women's basketball front, Team USA defeated Brazil to win gold at the AmeriCup tournament in Chile. Vanderbilt guard, shout out to Vanderbilt, Michaela Blakes, was awarded MVP honors after leading Team USA with 27 points in the championship game. She's only going into her sophomore season, you guys. She's going to be really, really good. This was, if you're unfamiliar with the AmeriCup, this was like an all-star type team of the best college players from around the USA. All the other countries were pretty much using their pro players. Like Brazil had Camila Cardoso and Damiris Dantas, who both play in the WNBA, playing on this team. And Team USA was all college players. They were also coached by Duke's head coach, Kara Lawson, and she led them to go gold. She is an incredible coach. So shout out to Team USA and women's basketball there. All right. I hope you feel caught up and primed for a great conversation coming up next. We're going to hear from an investigative reporter from the Washington Post, Albert Samaha. This is She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
From Odyssey Sports, it's She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
Today's guest is investigative reporter for the Washington Post, Albert Samaha. Albert, welcome to She's Got Next.
Thanks so much for having me. Thrilled to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited, and I want to just start with diving into your recent published story for the Post about women's basketball fandom, how it's changed in recent years, and the cost of growth that comes with women's sports and women's basketball and the WNBA kind of being on the rise. You talked to some season ticket holders with the New York Liberty, but what were some things that stood out to you the most when reporting this story?
Coming into this project, I was really curious to know about the experiences of people that have been going to W games longer than I had. I've only been, you know, shamefully going to women's sporting events maybe for the last like 2, 3, 4 years. And I really noticed how different the vibe was for most of the men's sporting events that I've been to over many years. A lot less people are drunk, a lot more families, a lot more kids. People walk up like the right side of the staircase and down, you know, the other side of the staircase. It's just
so
a lot
polite.
More, yeah, and everyone just seems very like aware of their space and like celebrating of the game, which is like very polar opposite from, you know, as anyone knows who's been to any sort of men's basketball or football or baseball game. So as I started going to more Liberty games, I live in Brooklyn. I just was really curious to hear from the experience of people that had been there longer, because as like a fan of any cultural element knows, anytime the thing you love goes mainstream, it draws in, you know, all these new fans that bring all these different mindsets and perspectives and lived experiences to it that might be foreign to like the culture and community that that sort of built before then. So I was curious to hear their perspective about how things have changed, and particularly, you know, as more and more kind of divisive discourse started to swirl around the W and women's basketball generally, while at the same time, players were getting more attention, getting more sponsorships, getting more money, especially at the college level. Those two things got sort of had this tension in my mind that reminded me a lot of the elements of like gentrification that I think about as, you know, a transplant living in Brooklyn. So I wanted to sort of come in with that mindset as someone who is an outsider, coming into a community that has been well established for decades before I got there, to kind of just learn. I didn't really have any I had some hypotheses, I had some theories, but no pre-existing conclusions. So I just wanted to go there and speak with these fans to see what their experience has been like, to see this thing they love really blow up, become popular, and have way more amenities than it once did, while also kind of the other side of that coin and the negative things that are also coming in as the sport becomes more mainstream.
And that is really the hardest part about being a women's sports fan these days, because it feels like one of those things where you've been listening to a local artist and you've been like, I have been on this thing for so long and now everybody's in on it and now they're on the radio and now they have all these opinions, but I was here first. And when you talk to some of those Liberty fans, they were literally there first from the first season. So what did they kind of see from what changed from that very first season? The New York Liberty is one of the few teams left that were the original teams from the WNBA to 2025, where it is now. They're in Barclays. It's sold out. What kind of changes have they seen throughout those years?
I mean, they've really been through it as a fan base. You know, like, first of all, like, the owner for much of the Liberty's history was James Dolan, who Knicks fans on the men's side don't even like as an owner. So you can just imagine, you know, how folks on the women's side are feeling when you know, that side's getting even more neglect than the men's side, right? So this is a team that started in Madison Square Garden, had some very successful early years. Teresa Witherspoon, you know, led them to like four finals in the first 6 years of the WNBA history. They had a lot of heartbreaking losses, but they were kind of one of the more exciting teams, I think. But they had sort of this dysfunctional ownership group that could not really find it a home. So there were some games where they had to move elsewhere. They had to move to Radio City Music Hall and play on this stage in an amphitheater because James Dolan hosted the Republican National Convention at Madison Square Garden one summer. There was another stretch of years where Dolan moved the team to Newark across state lines in New Jersey, which is kind of a pain to get to for people from New York City. There was another stretch more recently where they moved them all the way up to Westchester County, which is kind of the suburbs north of New York City, into this tiny arena with about a capacity of 5,000 people. And the fans mentioned that that's when a lot of season ticket holders really dropped off over those nomadic years. And over that period, they were not a bad team. They were not a great team. They were a middling team. And then in 2019, that's where Joe and Clara Tsai, who owned the New Jersey, the Brooklyn Nets, that's when they bought the Liberty and just invested a ton of money. They got big free agency signings. Breonna Stewart came, Jonquel Jones, two like MVP caliber players, built it around Sabrina. Suddenly you have this like super team that reaches the heights of the WNBA, you know, ladder, just as the sport is becoming more and more successful. So this intersection was really a lot for these fans to take in, where suddenly this team that had been bad is all of a sudden very good. Now they're playing at Barclays Center, a state-of-the-art arena in Brooklyn, which is where a lot of fans were already living to begin with. And they have these owners that are so invested in the team that they're breaking the rules. In 2022, they got fined $500,000 from the WNBA because they were flying players on a charter jet, which was against the collective bargaining agreement at the time, because it was an unfair competitive advantage for the other players who were flying commercial. Of course, now everyone's on the charter jets as the league has sort of been embarrassed by that. But at the time, the Liberty were ahead of the curve there. So for these fans, it's like, oh my God, like, this is, as a sports fan, as you know, this is what you wait for your entire life. Most sports fans never get to experience their teams becoming championship contenders. And these fans waited 20 plus years. here comes the success. They got MVPs. They got the WNBA Finals. You know, they don't beat the Liberty that first year in 2023, but then the next year they beat the Lynx in one of the most exciting playoff series I've ever seen in any sport. And they reached the pinnacle. They reached this ecstasy. And yet some of them couldn't make it to the finals games at the end, because just as they were reaching this ecstasy, the league is booming. You know, the Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, that whole, you know, Paige Beckers, that whole era of women's basketball players who were bringing the sport to new heights, also brings in rising ticket prices, more fans, a supply and demand issue that we've seen, you know, across our capitalist economy. So just as the thing they've been waiting for is happening, and they're really appreciative, they're really glad that players are getting treated better, they're really glad that the environment is full, this thing that they've been telling people is great, suddenly more people are coming to see how great it is. And but now they're worried that it's like anything else. Here comes the demand. Are they going to get priced out? Is the sort of the toxicity that a lot of men are bringing from men's sports into the arena, into online forums, is that going to ruin this culture of inclusivity that they had built before? It was this culture where you don't really boo opposing players. You see them as like collaborators in the promotion of the sports. A man who just started going to Liberty game told me that, you know, he grew up in Dallas. He was a Mavericks fan. Anytime Tim Duncan from the Spurs came to town, they would boo the hell out of him. That was just part of it. And he goes to Liberty games, and he's surprised that even after breaking Liberty hearts, Asia Wilson comes into Barclay Center and gets a standing ovation. And that was just a realization for him, waking up to the reality of how different the culture of inclusion is in the W and a lot of women's sports versus what a lot of men are used to in a much more tribal atmosphere in men's sports.
So fascinating. And I want to dive into so many things that you broke down there. First, I want to say my gripe with the whole CBA fine of the ownership group with the private jet, they lost most of those games when they were flying private, by the way. So it was not at an unfair advantage. They just got to sleep and rest their bodies. But that's aside, because we have charter flights now. But I love what you included in the story about that fan who is a season ticket holder, who is a man, and said he realized that more men were at the Liberty games because the men's restroom line was longer and he never had to wait in the men's restroom line. But this idea that this inclusive environment is kind of tied to it mostly being women, typically what it has been for years. But now men are coming into this environment, and what we've seen online is more men commenting and more of this idea from the league of no space for hate and this uptick in abuse, really what it is, online. And I always wondered if that was trickling into the arenas, because it's one thing of being online, but now you're buying a ticket to go to these games and you're having that kind of same type of ingression. Did you see that kind of correlation there in your reporting?
I did a little bit. And, you know, I wanted to be careful both in the story and when I talk about the story, that like when I go to Liberty game, I just went to a Liberty game a couple weeks ago. I've been to a Valkyrie game this season. It's still a family friendly environment. Right. Like the vast majority of the fans there still live up to the culture that has been established, those expectations, those standards. Even a lot of the men, come in, and we're selective sample size. Right. A lot of the men that are going to W games seem to be coming in with a mindset that they're coming into a different space where they're not the dominant force. Men seem to be assimilating to the culture. All that still remains the case, right? But I think when you go from an environment where there is no tribalism, no toxicity, to one where there is even a little bit, it's very striking, it's very jarring, right? The first scene in my story was an Aces game against the Liberty in Brooklyn. It was a huge, one of the biggest games of the season, late in the playoffs. Steph Curry, AZ Fudd, Dawn Staley were all in the house. Jordan Childs was in the house. A lot of kids were there, and they're like, you know, basketball, youth uniforms. And it was a great environment most of the game, you know, maybe a little more rowdy than usual. And then as I put in the story, late in the game, in a tense moment, you just hear some man bellowing from the top, you know, F you Kelsey, to Kelsey Plum. And it stood out, you know, like everyone's heads turned, faces soured. And that's the thing, right, is that he might have been the only human in the entire arena who was interested in that kind of environment, that kind of fandom. Mm-hmm. And yet everyone can hear him, you know? And that's the thing about the way this toxin can like seep into like both online and in-person settings is that it doesn't take a lot to really cast a stench for everyone to have to deal with. So on one hand, you know, I think it's important to note that like the environment still is as pure as you'll find in major professional sports. And yet all it takes is a little bit of that toxicity to start to make it really change. So even though it might only be a very small fraction of people, they make a loud impact because it's so it's so exceptional to what everyone's used to. So it's starting to creep in. It varies in different arenas, right? Like based on what we're hearing from players, seems like in Indiana, you know, it's real serious and it's become real consistent. It's become almost like the expectation there. My experience, you know, when I've been to games in San Francisco, I've only been to one so far. I didn't experience any of that there. The games I've been to in New York, I've been to quite a few. It's up and down, right? I think the bigger games, when it's the Aces, maybe the Sky, the Lynx, there's a bit more mainstream fans. They bring a bit more of kind of the machismo, but it's not what you will find at a Knicks game or a Nets game. It's not what you find at a Warriors game. So I think that's the hard part here, is trying to explain that, yes, things are changing. You know, there's now a new condo on the block. There's a Whole Foods on the block, but there are still old neighborhoods, you know, old school people that have lived in this neighborhood for a long time, right? How do you sort of capture the moment something begins to change without sort of overstating that and claiming like, well, it's all gone now? Because it's not. You go to a WNBA game, it's still great, still family friendly. But you're starting to see a little bit of that online toxicity slowly start to creep in.
It's such a great comparison to gentrification, because that is what I was thinking about when I was reading this story. And with that is prices as well. You hinted at it. And when I remember I did a story on something similar to when the Warriors move to their new arena and they leave Oakland and they leave that community of Oakland, and who could afford those season tickets when they were bad? Like the Liberty not too long ago, they only won two games in a season. Those tickets were very, very cheap. Now you're a champion. You're in the shiny new stadium. You're getting a shiny new practice facility. And there comes with this uptick of we're excited about the growth, but that means you have to pay more because we want the players to make more. We want the league to make more. Shoot, I want to make more for covering the league. Like all of this goes together. But the other side of that is that ticket prices have to kind of pay for that. And I think about the expansion teams as well. They're coming in, they're paying a pretty penny to be a part of this league, $250 million at least. Now we're going to see that reflected and say, okay, we got to get some of that money back. So when you talk to some of these season ticket holders who were probably there from the very beginning when it did not cost much to now, how have they been on that side of that issue?
Yeah, I mean, you really nailed it. Like the Liberty, to their credit, they capped season ticket price increases at 25% for anyone who had their seats for more than 3 years. So trying to sort of protect the most loyal fans. But that's still a lot. 25% is still like a big increase for anything over a year-to-year period. But a lot of the season ticket holders I spoke with, they're filled with gratitude for the changes that they've seen, right? They're not shaking their fist at the cloud at these changes happening. This is what they wanted, you know? And the folks I spoke to, like, nobody was saying that the prices shouldn't go up, you know? Mm-hmm. Some people were saying, hey, I might not be able to pay this, but I understand. Other people were saying, I might have to budget a bit more, but I'm going to keep going. Because they know that they want players to get paid more. They want the league to have the attention that it's getting. They're not delusional about this, right? I think that the challenge, you know, when I kind of read the comments to my story or hear stuff like this talked about online, I hear some people say things like, well, you know, isn't this what W fans wanted? Isn't this inevitable, right? To me, that sort of holds to this false premise that, like, the way men's sports is the way it has to be. I think one of the really refreshing things I've seen in just following women's sports is that among the fans of women's sports that don't follow men's sports, there's this sense of fresh eyes that they apply to things that longtime men's sports fans take for granted. For example, the idea of a draft, which from a labor perspective is very problematic, right? Or the idea of a player getting traded instantly without being told, without being given a heads up after they just like bought a house and sent their kids to school in a new city. These are things that male sports fans like me have just sort of assumed are the way it's supposed to be. But then to hear women sports fans be like, wait a minute, this is kind of messed up. I'm like, wait a minute, this is kind of messed up. Why have we just accepted this, you know? And I sort of feel the same way with how fandom could be generally. Like, I think to me, the optimistic hope is that the W becoming more successful and more mainstream, hopefully there's like a cultural exchange, right? That it's not just men going to W games and bringing this negative atmosphere. Hopefully it's men going to W games, like that source Jeffrey I talked to, looking around and being like, oh, this is different. Maybe I actually like this better. Maybe this is something I could bring back to men's sporting events. So I think there's still like, it's not all like doom and gloom. I think there's a way in which the success of the W could actually rub off positively on men's sports in that way. And I think that's why I thought it was important to write about this issue like now, because, you know, mm-hmm. me and my editors were talking about it. We're like, well, it's just kind of early, right? Like, the neighborhood isn't totally gone to the men yet, right? It's still, but we felt it's important to capture it as early as possible, because once, you know, perhaps once, if ever there is a point of no return, it's too late, right? But if you can sort of capture early on, here is this culture that is not dying by any means, that still exists mm-hmm. and still exists like in a really strong way at W and NWSL and other women's sports arenas across the country. Here's something precious that's worth preserving. And as more and more mainstream fans like me, new fans coming in, let's think about what we're stepping into and let's be mindful of that. And I think a lot of the old school fans recognize that. That's what they want, right? It's like, come, we want new fans, but just read the room, which yes. is, I think women have been saying to men for generations. So.
Yeah, that kind of is a universal statement a little bit. I think you did a great job kind of catching this lightning in a bottle, which I think so many reporters and people in the media have been trying to do it, because it has been this, it's rare when it's such a sharp turn of events. And that's why it comes with some turbulence. That's what I've always said. With new fans, I welcome them all with open arms. But if you just come in so strong and so hot with anything, it's going to be like, okay, well, slow your roll. Let's get some context here. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's what this does so well. And I wanted to kind of ask, when did your start or your first interest in covering women's sports on an investigative level kind of begin? I know that you had one of those early stories between Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese in the national championship game in 2023. But what kind of sparked your interest to dive into it?
A couple of things, man. You know, I live in Brooklyn. I'd been meaning to go to Liberty games, and then I eventually went. But I was, like, embarrassed that I went the year that, like, Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese were blowing up women's college basketball. Like, I felt like I was jumping. I very consciously felt like I was jumping on the bandwagon. At the same time, a really good friend of mine, Tamara Griffin, who writes for The Athletic, she's been covering NWSL for a while. I went to a bunch of games with her. So that sort of brought me into just the women's sports ecosystem. So she gets a lot of credit for just kind of opening that world up to me from that end. And then, you know, me and my boys in the summer, you know, you always hear men talk about how, like, oh, summer's so boring, so sports on, you know? But it's like, that's the whole WNBA season in addition to many yes. other sports, right? And so we started, you know, we're Golden State Warrior fans. We're from the Bay Area. And, you know, the Warriors haven't been that good, you know, in a couple of years. So we just started going to Liberty games because we wanted that fix again. It's like we came in at the right time and the wrong time, right? It's like we came at the right time in the sense that it was the year the team was peaking, but the wrong time in the sense of, like, we were very clearly part of the problem potentially. And I'm pretty sure subconsciously that guilt played a role in me being like, oh, this is kind of messed up. And my just generally as a writer is like, anytime something makes me uncomfortable or feel guilty or ashamed, I know that means I need to write about it and I need to, like, really unpack it. And writing is my way of processing uncomfortable feelings. And I think a lot of this process for me stemmed from those uncomfortable feelings of being like, knowing someone like Tamara, who has been covering women's sports for a long time, gave me that sort of contrast of like, wait a minute, I know I'm new because here I am watching a game with someone who's been in it, right? So there was no delusions there. And then me going with my, like, groups of male friends to Liberty games, it was just hard for me to ignore the role I was playing, the complicity I had in the very changes that were like seeming to become more and more problematic. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, that's sort of how my like entrance into women's sports and my guilt about that, my complicity, and like, man, I'm part of the problem. I'm one of the people who was only watching men's sports for hella long, you know? I wanted to unpack that and talk to other men about it, talk to like women who had been longtime fans about it. But just wanting to sort of unpack a lot of the uncomfortable feelings I had and see if anyone else was thinking about it too that way.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll dive into the business side of women's sports and hear more from Albert about the NIL world in women's sports. You're listening to She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
Let's get down to business. Here's what's happening in the business of women's sports.
Welcome back to She's Got Next. It's time for Let's Get Down to Business, where we talk about the business of women's sports. The NIL world is complicated in college sports, to say the least. During my talk with Albert Samaha, we dove into this conversation a little bit and how it's affected women's college athletes. Here's what he had to say. I'm sure there's so many people who are in that same boat. First of all, welcome. We're so happy you're here. It's a lot of drama. It's a lot going on this side, but it's a lot of fun. So I'm so happy that you're here on this side. And I think with that too, because you cover college athletics as well and the NIL space, and so much that we are seeing from the WNBA side is a lot of fans are coming from college. That interest and those big names like a Caitlin Clark, like an Angel Reese, that starts from the college space. And when we talk about those college athletes that I know you did a lot of reporting on that I want to pick your brain on before I let you go, is this whole idea with NIL and specifically women's athletes and their role in that. And I thought it was so fascinating that it's not only this new untapped world that we know a lot about, but also don't know a lot about. There's like a lot of regulation, but also not a lot of regulation. But when it comes to women's athletes, it's not necessarily this pay-to-play model, right? They seem like they have to work harder for their followers, for their social media following. That I also feel like is the same in the pro space as well. If you have a lot of followers as a pro athlete, your salary does not automatically go up. It's all of the other things that kind of go into it. So I guess just generally, as you're diving into women's sports, as you're following that curiosity, what kind of stuck from your NIL reporting from women's sports?
The disparity, the pay disparity, and you know the idea of a pay disparity between men and women is not new, of course, right? It's not limited to sports. But I think what was striking is, you know, we got a bunch of records from public records requests from different universities, and we were able to put together an incomplete but informative glimpse into the NIL economy, and isolating to see like what men's college basketball players were getting and women's college basketball players were getting really raised the question of like, who is determining the value of these players' abilities? Mm-hmm. Because from a fan perspective, like subjectively and anecdotally speaking, women's college basketball is much more central to like the sports discourse than men's college basketball. I stopped watching men's college basketball a long time ago, and I've been watching women's college basketball for like a minute now. I know a lot of friends the same. If you just watch SportsCenter and like all the debate shows on TV, it's the same. If you're online at all, you will see we're going even back to like 2022, 2023. You would see so much about women's college basketball and almost nothing about men's college basketball. There was a point where I could not name a single men's college basketball player while I could name like 20 women's college basketball players.
Yes.
All of which is to say that like, when we say a men's college basketball player is worth $1 million and a women's college basketball player is worth like $300,000 or whatever, and I'm just pulling these numbers out of thin air, but those are the sort of disparities we were seeing. Who's deciding that? Well, it's, you're not going to be surprised to hear, a room full of men who are like yes, running the booster programs. And because it's, and I, look, I don't know the ages of these people, so I don't want to like project generational biases, but it's a room full of men. And we did look to see like, who are the people who had all of these collectives across the country, it's like, it was like 90%+ men, right? And men who are like, who still believe that like men's college basketball is more important to the university than women's college basketball, which is just an antiquated perspective, like not based on much evidence, if any. You know, it was just based on vibes, basically, and the momentum of it. And that was striking to me because, yes, it, you know, when you have like men's football in there, it sort of skews things because that's just the biggest money-making sport in college generally. But just to isolate basketball and then to see how it applies in other sports that are non-revenue generating and how men are still getting more than a lot of women, it showed the need for some kind of like regulation and how like Title IX wasn't applying at all, right? So like after like all this work to create laws to ensure equity between men and women college athletes, suddenly this new system comes in and entirely wipes away 50 years of practice because of some loopholes that create some legal distance between like the universities and the collectives. So to me, that was what was concerning, is that we had this new economy that was emerging with no guardrails, and at that point, very little sense of whether there would be any sort of regulation that was exacerbating these disparities that we had already addressed.
Wow. I mean, that could be a whole nother episode that I might have to bring you back when it comes to the college season, because we know that, and I love that you put in your story, like the LSU women's team was the only one that kind of outperformed and got paid more than their men's team when they won a national championship. Like, that makes sense. Like, they're actually good. But somehow, all of that doesn't really matter. And it's just because of, men's basketball and football. That should be that. And that goes into the latest ruling. And how is that going to affect a lot of already we're seeing lawsuits based off of Title IX coming up because of that. So I want to dive more deeper into that at a later time, especially when we get to the college season. But I love how there's a connection to the pro sports there too, that women's athletes need to be on social, you know, capturing everything, and their salaries are still not matching that. Do you feel like there is a little comparison there in the pro level?
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I should have mentioned that in your last question, but that is the thing that we found from our research, was that men were basically getting paid to play, right? They were getting like the big collective deals. That's just like, you come here, you'll get $1 million. You do a little bit of charity, you sign some basketballs, you get $1 million. Women were getting money from brand deals, right? So it's like, and anyone who's done any sort of like content creation online, that's work, you know, that's editing. That's like, work, or that's giving a cut of your profits to a management company who does the editing for you.
Right.
So the idea was that women, the women who are making as much as the men, had to do it from like this different sort of labor, from actual labor. Even if that labor, even if it was a high profile player like Angel Reese or Kiki Rice, where they're not doing the actual editing most of the time if they're doing like a Gatorade ad, but they're still taking time out of their day to do the shoot, do all this and that, whereas a lot of the men's athletes were getting more money to do less. And I think that's it, right? Like, when people talk about Caitlin Clark's salary being less than like an average person's salary, it's like, because she's making her riches from endorsement money, right? Whereas NBA players don't need to do that. So it's sort of, that's where the new disparity lies, where, and we're seeing it in college and the pros, where the women that are making like top dollar are making maybe as much as men are, but it's a very small number, and it's only like those who were reaching like a certain level of fame, whereas like the third best player on a playoff team, the third best player on a Final Four team, women's side versus men's side, that's where we really see the disparity, right? Yeah. It's below the elite and into the rank and file, and that's where the biases really come to the surface.
Fascinating, because I guess you think about the disparities between men and women, but it's also within the women's teams. Not everybody is making Libby Dunn, who was a famous gymnastics player, money. You are so smart, brilliant. Thank you for your time, Albert, investigative reporter for the Washington Post. Thank you, and we'll have you back.
Yeah, thanks, Jordan. Thanks for having me. Happy to come back anytime. Appreciate chatting with you.
Thank you again to Albert for joining the show. Make sure to read his work on the Washington Post and go back and read his multiple articles that dive into the NIL world. It's really, really great stuff. All right. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson. I hope you had a blast. I hope you learned a lot. I know I sure did. I could have talked to Albert for hours, and maybe we'll bring him back when the college season is about to start. But thank you so much for listening. This has been She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.